You are listening to Press Pass, brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of Press Pass on GNAT TV. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's news project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Friday, June 4th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined here in our virtual studio by two of the top reporters in the state who cover state politics in the legislature. Xander Landon covers politics in the state legislature for VT Digger, and so does Greg Sukenik, who covers politics in the state legislature for the Brattleboro Reformer, the Bennington Banner, and perhaps most importantly, the Manchester Journal. Anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much for making the time today to be with us and share your insights and thoughts of the legislative session, which seemed to have wrapped up a week or so ago. Seemed like it came to a somewhat amicable conclusion there, with a budget being passed and everyone going home and apparently relieved to not be on Zoom all day long for 4 or 5 days a week. But earlier this week, we found out that, to the contrary, the legislature will be returning, at some point, I guess, later this month, for a veto override session. Governor Phil Scott, vetoed a couple of bills that would have allowed for non-citizen voting, in Winooski and Montpelier, in local elections, to be clear. They wouldn't have included them for state or federal elections, but, those changes to those two towns' charters met with the governor's veto pen, and in response to that, legislative leaders, Senator Becca Ballant of Brattleboro and the or Windham County, I should say, who's the Senate pro tem leader, and Representative Jill Kowinski, the House Speaker, both said they would bring the legislature back to attempt to override the governor's veto. So, well, let's start there. And Xander, let me go start with you first, if I may. What is your sense of this? Do you think those vetoes stand a good chance of being overridden?
I think it's probably going to be close. I can't say for sure whether they're going to survive this session. The votes on the two measures were pretty close in the House to the threshold needed. In fact, one met that threshold. And the threshold for overcoming a veto is a two-thirds majority vote. So in the House, that means 100 votes. In the Senate, that means 20 votes. And in the Senate, in both cases, these proposals that would have allowed non-citizen voting in those two towns or cities, as you mentioned, met the 20-vote threshold. In the House, the Montpelier vote charter change got 103 votes. And I believe in the House, the Winooski change got 99 votes. So it's not clear, and you know the dynamic completely changes in a veto override setting. And Republicans typically will support Governor Scott categorically in instances where there's a veto override attempt. And I don't think many Republicans supported these measures, but it is a different calculus to some degree on both sides in a veto override setting. So I think there will be attempts to muster the votes from Democratic leaders to get this done. The fact that they're holding a vote or plan to hold a vote to override means they're pretty comfortable, I think, in the fact that they have the votes or could get the votes, because usually they don't want to hold these sort of votes unless they think they're going to overcome the veto. So we'll see in the coming weeks. It's going to be held. This veto session is going to be held later this month, I think June 23rd, 24th.
What do you think elevated these two cases to prompt Senator Ballant and Representative Kowinski to go to an override session? I mean, this is like they both said that it's local control question here, that it's the right of the townships to kind of make their own rules around that. But it kind of surprised me, to be frank, about the fact that they thought, well, this is so critical that we need to call the legislature back into session for it.
You want me to take a swing at this one?
Sure.
I think it's usually charter changes sail through. They're a reflection of the voters' will in the community they're coming from. And I think there was some surprise that the governor, you know, didn't sign on when these things had been vetted through the legislative process. I think they're also I sense there's a feeling that, you know, the governor was talking about there needed to be more conversation on setting a standard for non-citizen voting. The legislature would say, well, wait a minute, we had that conversation. It's called the legislature. I think those are pretty much Senator Ballant's words almost. And, you know, I think there's a question of precedent, and there's also a question of, you know, yeah, we did the due diligence and this is what the voters wanted. And so I think there's kind of a principle there. There's also a question of whether S-107, which was a bill that would release information about juveniles who were first arrested and accused of a crime, whether that information would be released to the public. The governor also vetoed that, and I think that's also going to be on the agenda. And there's also a possibility that some other bills that were right at the finishing line but didn't make it to the governor's desk might jump in. S-79, which addresses the potential for a rental unit registry and also some grant money for opening up apartments, is also is one of those bills that might fit that criteria, because it had passed, it simply didn't make it to the Senate back in time. And if we know one thing about the housing market right now, it's that, you know, there's a serious issues with price, and that's trickling down to affect the rental market as well.
What were your major takeaways from the session? What do you think were the primary accomplishments that the legislature succeeded at? And what were some of the issues that got punted over to next year, which, of course, is an election year, which creates a different dynamic from an off-year election? Xander, I'll start with you. What comes to mind first when you think about this past session in terms of legislation that was passed?
Well, this session, you know, from the beginning was sort of defined by the pandemic. It was remote. Legislators were sort of limited and strained by that in that sense. It's not the same, you know, deal legislating via Zoom that it is legislating in the State House in Montpelier. I think that the biggest accomplishment, which really was sort of fueled not as much by legislating in Montpelier, really, you could argue, as by the federal government, is the budget this year and the amount of money that legislators were able to sort of direct to a variety of causes. And the governor was involved in that as well. But basically, the federal ARPA bill, the American Rescue Plan, gave state leaders, you know, $1 billion+ to work with above and beyond what they spend, you know, typically on a budget, that they were able to direct to, you know, climate change initiatives, water and sewer projects, about $200 million in affordable housing related investments, $150 million for broadband expansion, basically getting into these big problems that they wanted to address, or big investments that they wanted to make for years on a bipartisan basis. So the fact that they were able to sort of come to an agreement on how to spend this money, these different tranches, these different big investments, and get a budget passed with agreement from the governor is definitely, in my view, the biggest accomplishment. But it sort of was sort of based on the sort of manna from heaven from the federal government. It's not, you know, we're not raising taxes, we're not making big sort of fiscal changes here, but we're benefiting, as all states are, from the federal windfall. The biggest sort of hang up of the session, I would say, was the pension issue, which really started in the House. The House had both Democratic sort of leadership teams had identified the pension crisis as a big priority this year because of projections that the debt from the system is only going to grow and balloon by hundreds of millions of dollars beyond what we had thought in the coming years. So there was an attempt, a big sort of priority made at the beginning of the year. We're going to sort of get at the systemic issue here. We're going to find a way to address this fiscal crisis. And the House put forward a plan that sparked a huge political backlash from state employees, public sector employees, teachers, the unions, that would essentially would have involved cutting benefits, forcing state workers to work longer before they can draw down their pensions. And this wasn't like the plan that was going to be enacted, but it was an initial sort of first stab at a plan. And that and the reaction from that was enough to sort of get the Democratic leadership to say, okay, we have to slow down. We need to take a more thoughtful approach here. Bring everyone to the table, hopefully in an in-person environment where it's maybe easier to work something like this out and come up with a big systemic solution next year to the pension issue. There was some work done this year to reform the governance system, the system for making investments in the state pensions, as well as money set aside to address this issue in the coming years. A lot of money, $150 million was set aside. But the big sort of thorniest aspect of this reform of the pension system was pushed off till next year. And like you said, it's an election year. So it's going to arguably be even harder to deal with a big sort of headache of an issue like this when everyone's up for re-election. And, you know, this was certainly the biggest political calamity of the year. And it's only going to continue to be one next year. So we'll see if they actually are able to do this next year in an election year, if there actually is going to be an appetite to do it. There's a task force working on this over the summer that's going to come up with recommendations, but it's a big TBD on the pensions.
And Greg, your thoughts on this subject?
You correctly pointed out, Xander, that this is going to wind up being settled in an election year. And I mean, the employee unions are, you know, traditionally a big part of the Democrats' coalition. And so to put forward proposals that might cut into benefits, lengthen time of service, how does that play? That's a bit of a risk. And while it would have been very difficult to try to cram something through in this session over Zoom, they are sort of trading some time for space, but that doesn't mean that the next day's battle is going to be any easier. I think it also offers some a window for progressives to make some inroads with those employee unions. I mean, they're a small part of the House. They have 7 seats in the House, but I mean, they can make the point that, hey, we're fighting for you on this. And you know, where they need to make inroads is in committees. They need to sort of, this might be an opportunity for them to gain back some ground that they've ceded over the past couple of years. Back to more accomplishments. I would agree completely with Xander on the budget being sort of the major and the effect that ARPA dollars had overall on the legislature's work. I remember, a year ago when the legislature was finished up the fiscal 21 budget, there were warnings that fiscal 22 was going to be a lot harder. And I mean, I think that's what we were all expecting. And then this, $1 billion literally drops out of the sky and makes possible massive housing investments, massive investment in broadband, which is, there's also the child care bill. I would point to as another accomplishment, H-171. And while a lot of that sort of also pushes things forward to studies with regards to what the state can afford to do, it does start to open up some of the eligibility for families receiving financial aid for child care, which was identified as a big need during the pandemic. And it does start to look at some scholarships and some loan forgiveness for early childcare workers who are If you're looking for folks who are paid less than we do, that's early childcare workers. So that's been identified as a need and something that they're, hoping that this is going to help. I would also, in terms of other accomplishments, and things that also kind of got kicked down the, it was kind of part accomplishment, part kicking the can, was the way that they sort of went about the per pupil weighting study. Because yes, they addressed it. Yes, they set up a task force that's going to look at how to implement these new per pupil weights for school budgets. But at the same time, that's got to come forward next year. And as a result of the way they structured it. And that also means that there's the potential of lawmakers having to go back to their voters in communities where property taxes have increased as a result of the change in weights and try to explain their position. So next year is going to be, that's another big political issue that's going to wind up at their feet in an election year.
What did you make of how the new leadership in the legislature did this year? Both House Speaker Kerwinski and Senate Pro Tem Leader Ballant were, this is their first year on the job. Last year, it seemed relations between Governor Scott and then Senate Leader Tim Ash and House Speaker Mitzi Johnson seemed to be a little tense from time to time, and at least from this remove here, it seemed like their working relationship wasn't quite as jovial as it might have been. Did the new team do better this year? Do you think it's sort of greasing the legislative wheels and making the sausage, or were they just fortunate that there was such an avalanche of federal money that came through to kind of make everything a lot easier? The problem was not so much how do we spend our very, very, very limited resources, but how do we allocate all this money we didn't expect to have?
I'm going to go first on that one this time. I'm going to say, while this is the first year as Speaker and Pro Tem respectively for Jill Kerwinski and for Becca Ballant, they're not lost in the woods here. They both were majority leader for multiple terms before they came. So they had a working relationship. And I think that makes a big difference. They've figured out how to move forward together and show unity on a number of issues. There's obviously, there's always things that they're not going to agree perfectly on and things that their members are not going to agree perfectly on. But, to the extent that those were issues, they managed to sort of keep those in house and sort of kept the unified front moving forward. And I got the sense that they worked better with the governor. A lot of that's behind closed doors. There wasn't a budget veto, for example, and I think that certainly shows some ability to where there had been a hint that the governor didn't like the way the ARPA spending had been structured. So I think there's hints that it was effective. It's very easy for us to sit and be, play Monday morning quarterback on some things, some decisions, because if it was easy, anyone could do it. Should the House have stuck to its guns on the pension? The heat was going to get, they knew that the heat was going to be there when they put that forward. I don't think that should have come as a surprise to anyone. If I was going to second guess a decision, maybe that would be the one I would second guess. But, it seemed, and having $1 billion in federal money to spend also makes life a lot easier too. But it seemed like they were more effective than Mitzi Johnson and Tim Ash were able to be. And maybe it's their experience, maybe it's the circumstances, maybe it's a combination of the two. But I felt like they were fairly effective.
And Xander, your takeaway on that?
I think that the new leaders have made strong attempts to improve communication between the chambers, the House and the Senate, and also with the governor's office. It seems, they're openly talking about the legislative leaders and the governor about how they meet frequently and work together. But I think that there are other factors at play here that made this year a little easier than a normal legislative session would be. One is that in some ways, like you said, the money coming in and the pandemic itself was sort of able to diffuse a bit of the political, normal political tensions that you see. It's able to sort of bring everyone together to some degree. And a lot of the issues that were talked about in the budget and with the federal money were issues where there was broad consensus. These are all things that everyone's wanted to fund for a long time. So there wasn't really any flashpoint. And that's also because the nature of the pandemic made it so that the Democrats really weren't inclined to pursue issues that are controversial for the governor. You know, in past years, we've seen big fights over minimum wage increases, paid family leave, which is still, you know, arguably one of the biggest priorities for the Democrats in Vermont, but they didn't touch paid leave this year. And that's because they didn't want to tackle this big issue that they know is going to get a veto in a year where they have to deal with the pandemic or legislating remotely. So they're not taking the same sort of swings that they would maybe in a normal setting, legislative setting. And those were the sort of issues that got, you know, the former leaders into sort of conflict with the governor. I'd also say that the governor, you know, when he was starting out and when we saw a lot of his vetoes come down in his first couple years in office, has also taken a slightly different approach with the legislature now as he's sort of been on the job for many years now. We saw much bigger fights between the executive and the legislature in his first 2 years in office when he was more actively pursuing an agenda in the legislature on issues around education, funding, and taxes. He softened his approach a little bit, and that's borne out in recent years, and it's certainly you can see that now as well. But in general, I do think that there's a different, slightly different approach when it comes to communication and collaboration with these two leaders.
Interesting.
One quick real side note on that. I wonder how much of that is a result of the election results. That goes back to the pandemic as well. And just really quickly, one accomplishment I failed to mention should have is the incredible infusion of funds that was put into the state colleges system, which, you know, had been, you know, systematically starved over a period of decades until it darn near collapsed as a result of the pandemic. And now there's this, you know, major infusion of cash. I should have mentioned that before. I wanted to get that in.
Any thoughts on whether or not Senator Leahy would want, who's I think 82 now, one of the most senior senators in the U.S. Senate, and has been given a lot of credit for steering a lot of the ARPA money and federal dollars Vermont's way, making sure that the state got cut in for a good share. Any thoughts on whether or not you might say, hey, you know, had a good run, time to go back to my home in Vermont? Xander, you want to take a crack at this one first, and then we'll go to Greg.
Yeah, I mean, I think that all indications are that he's still undecided on this matter. He has, you know, he said basically he's going to take till the end of the year to make a decision. There certainly is some pressure for him to run again, in the sense that he's in an extremely powerful perch. He's the chair of the Appropriations Committee. He's has a lot of seniority. He's currently the longest serving member of the Senate, and is the Senate president pro tempore, which makes him, I believe, third in line for the presidency. So he's got a lot of power. He, as you said, steers a lot of money and resources to the state that likely wouldn't be here unless he was in his current position. And you know, you also have Senator Sanders on the budget committee. So Vermont has a lot of influence in the Senate right now. So there's pressure for him to continue to sort of serving in the capacity that he is. But like you said, he's getting older, and there's also a tension where there are a lot of people waiting in the wings who, you know, are interested in running for Congress. I don't know to what extent that's going to influence Senator Leahy, but it's something else that's going on. You haven't had an open Senate seat or congressional seat, period, in Vermont since the mid-2000s. And all indications are that Peter Welch, current House representative, is preparing to run for Senate in the event that Leahy does step down. There are also a lot of other contenders that would be interested in the congressional seat, Representative Welch's seat, in the event he ran for Senate. Becca Ballant, the pro tem of the Vermont Senate, has said she's interested. There's also, you know, a lot of talk about Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray being interested in running for Congress and a bunch of others. And the state has never sent a woman to Congress before. We're the only state in the country to have not done that. And there's, you know, in Democratic circles, there's always talk about, you know, we really need, and not even in, you know, bipartisan sense, there's talk that, you know, the state really needs to do that, to elect a woman to Congress. So there, yeah, there's a lot of speculation at this point is really all that there is. But there's indications of, you know, people ready to make moves in the event that he does step down.
And Greg, what's your thought on that?
I think when we do have a decision, and if Senator Leahy does decide not to pursue a ninth term at this point, you know, the chess pieces are going to move so fast it's going to make your head spin. I mean, keep in mind that Peter Welch is the youngster of the congressional delegation, and he's 74 years old. And, you know, Xander's point about the lack of female representation from Congress, I think that's, I mean, if I was a betting person and I wanted to put money on, you know, whether Vermont's next, you know, congressional representative was going to be a woman, I would put a lot of money down on that prospect. There's a lot of pressure for Senator Leahy to stick around because he does have seniority, and that's valuable in the Senate. I mean, there's also concern that, you know, that you have an entire sort of generation, you know, of leadership that needs to move forward, and that there's some stagnancy there. And he's got his, you know, his own health to consider, his wife's health to consider. So it's funny how the personal becomes, you know, very political very quickly. I really don't know which I'm trying not to speculate, actually, because I really don't know which way the senator is going to go. I do know that. What's already shaping up to be a very interesting political year in 2022 would just be that much more so. It would go to bonkers level if Senator Leahy did decide not to run and we suddenly had a complete reshuffling of the deck. I think it would make for a fascinating year and for a lot of bylines for myself and Mr. Landon here.
Definitely.
We tend to root for the story, you know. You know, as reporters, we can't root for teams. We can sort of root for the story. And I mean, to that extent, there would be no shortage of fascinating storylines if, in fact, that's what came to pass.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. I just want to thank both of you again for making the time for this conversation. Xander Landon of VT Digger, Greg Sirkenick of the Manchester Journal, Bennington Banner, and Brattleboro Reformer. And hope thanks to all of you for tuning in and watching the show. Hope you found it interesting. And we'll see you again the next time. Meanwhile, have a great day.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.